The next case is 95-869. The next case is 95-869, Keith Anderson, Administrator versus St. Francis St. George Hospital. Justice Stratton has recused herself from this case, and we're pleased to have Justice Bowman move to her chair for this case. Ms. Light.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Deborah Light and I represent the appellant, St. Francis St. George Hospital, in this matter. I'd also like to introduce Kathleen Ballard, who is appearing on behalf of the AMICI, the Ohio Hospital Association, and the Ohio State Medical Association. I have requested that she be permitted to participate in this argument. I understand that that request has been granted.
Yes, it wasn't filed pursuant to the rule, but I understand if all counsel are agreeable, I'm willing to grant it.
Thank you, Your Honor. And as time permits, I think she'll just be speaking for a minute or two. I would also request 1 minute for rebuttal purposes.
Yeah, you'll need to watch your time on the clock closely there to give her time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel, in this case, just about damages?
Yes.
That's the only issue here today?
Here today, yes. The issues of negligence, whether a battery occurred, have never been addressed yet by the trial court, by the appellate courts, or by any other court. There was an appeal, as you know, previously to this court, which was rejected. That issue has never been looked at. We have not asked for it to be looked at.
And you'll have a chance to come back to this, but I want to push you. You say, as a matter of public policy, there can be and should be no damages, period.
There should be no damages in this particular situation where the claim is that the gentleman who was defibrillated went on to live.
Right. Okay.
He went on to live.
So what is the sanction for a hospital that does this? And I assume there's no claim that this was intentional, that this was...
There's not really a suggestion.
That's not the case, that your hospital regularly takes patients in, puts in the chart, no code, and then, as a matter of policy, just ignores that. That's not this case.
That's not this case, and to be more accurate about the facts, this gentleman had standing orders to defibrillate, to monitor. He had a heart monitor attached to his heart. He was in a room where he was being monitored for heart problems.
Okay, there seems to be a dispute on facts.
On whether the DNR order conflicted with the order to defibrillate and so forth. The gentleman's physician had been deposed and said he himself wouldn't have known whether to defibrillate if he had been there at 2:30 in the morning. But he did go on to put the gentleman on further resuscitative medications after the defibrillation, even though the DNR order was there.
But you would agree that this kind of decision is extremely important for many people.
I think it is important for many people, but not simply for patients. This is not a right to die decision. This is not a case involving...
No, I mean the individual decision when you tell the doc,
yes,
because of my age, my medical conditions, we've all decided no heroic measures.
Yes.
That's extremely important.
Absolutely. And if they don't...
And if that's ignored, there are no damages.
It's not a question of it being ignored and therefore there are no damages. There simply are no damages. If this gentleman had rib fractures, bruises, burns or something, there would be damages associated with it. He did not. He had life afterwards, and that's what they claim
the
damages are.
But there were heroic means used. He didn't want them. No damages.
There's still a question remaining about whether he wanted them, and as much as he thanked the nurse for defibrillating him.
Is there no sanction on a hospital that that, say, regularly engages in that kind of activity?
Absolutely, there would be a sanction if one was warranted. You could go before, since a nurse was involved, you could go before the nursing board. If a physician was involved, you could go before the medical board. You could ask that something be looked into. But just as if we had a case that involved...
How does joint commission view something like this?
Well, it's not actually a part of the record, but the joint commission does come in and look at your policies to make sure that your policies are appropriate, whether they be DNR policies, medication policies, standing order policies. So certainly they could look at any conflicts that were brought.
Would it be a high-level violation if they found...
In this situation, there is no precedent whatsoever to suggest whether they would find this to be a high violation or something else. But I think that as part of the problem that's brought us here is that the appellate court on the second go-round was bothered by the fact that they felt there had been a violation and yet there might not be some remedy. And therefore they wanted to create a remedy, even though the law of the case, as decided by the first appellate court and as the appeal came up here and was rejected, became the law of the case, the second court was still uncomfortable with the fact that there might not be a remedy. I would submit that this case is no different than any other case where negligence would occur, recklessness would occur, willful and wanton misconduct would occur with no damages. You must have damages in order to prove all of the elements of a case. There are no damages that are compensable here.
Ms. Light, yes. I'm going to take this case in for a different reason. Now,
yes.
Just accept that I understand your argument about this is life and how can life ever be a damage. I wrote the Johnson case.
I understand that.
So I understand your argument, and if you'll just bear with me. My concern is, given the prevalence now, and we have an ever-growing number of living wills and durable power of attorney for health care, supposing either or both of those were in effect in this case.
Yes.
Can the hospital ignore those with impunity?
No, absolutely not, and I don't think there was a claim that it was ignored with impunity.
No, I'm not even talking about this case.
Yes.
I think that's where it goes. Or at least it worries me a little that it might go there, that here they had a specific instruction. Clearly it was not a living will, clearly it was not a durable power of attorney for health care. But they had a written instruction on the chart.
Yes.
Now, ergo, does it happen that if you can ignore it here, would our decision in reversing then say to preserve life, either one of the other documents could be ignored?
No. If you look at those statutes which were enacted after this incident, they specifically state in there that there will be, in essence, immunity for a health care provider that goes ahead and provides care despite one of these. But the health care provider is obligated to transfer the patient to someone else who can follow the orders. In this case, this family asked the patient be moved to a room where he would not be on a monitor, he would not be in an intermediate care unit, the standing orders would not be in place. He was moved. After he was moved, he suffered a stroke.
I guess I didn't realize the statute went on and said, I just prepared for myself and living well in a, I guess I had somebody else prepared.
Good, I'm glad we could get that for you.
I can understand your concern.
All I can tell you is I've studied the statute and I didn't remember that I have a right to have, that they have a right to ignore that and transfer me to somebody else.
Well, because
is
of
that
the
what the statute says? They're immune for ignoring the written
document? It says that they may not be held liable in a civil case for failure to honor those, but they must transfer the patient.
Yeah,
because of the conflict with the Hippocratic Oath, because of the conflict that some people feel with their own religion or for whatever reasons, if they feel they cannot honor it, then the patient is to be transferred. And again, those statutes were enacted afterwards, but when they were enacted, this case had been in the press everywhere. This was a very well-known case. They did nothing to set up a cause of action that would allow for this type of case to go forward. And I would submit to you that if this court were to establish some type of cause of action without clear-cut parameters as to how a jury is to view this case, think of the various scenarios that may result. We could have a case where someone comes in, is perfectly fine, but was defibrillated, has gone on to live for a couple of years, has written books, has gathered wealth, maybe even has changed his mind, likes his life. How is a jury to decide what the value of that life is at that point? Or if someone becomes blind or crippled or paralyzed, are they supposed to decide that that life is not worth
living? We're talking about Mr. Winter here.
Yes.
How did he like his life those last 2 years?
Well, it's debatable. I mean, that would be something we would certainly raise at trial, but this is a gentleman who came in with a heart condition.
But they never got to trial. You got out on summary.
Correct.
And isn't that the problem?
Well, no. The problem would be if we did go to trial and a jury was asked to try to figure out how much of that life was worth. And what did they compare it to? They would have to compare it to death. Now, what parameters do they have to compare it to death? They don't know what death is about.
Well, doesn't Johnson apply then? If it goes to trial, since Johnson applies the so-called joy of life, that would be an issue here with him, but that's intangible. You can't put a value on it.
That is our problem, and I'm sure that's why Justice Douglas wrote the opinion the way he did, that life is not a compensable harm. Even in the dissent that was written in that case, it said it should not matter whether it's a healthy child at issue or an unhealthy child. Similarly, I don't think it should matter whether it's a healthy individual or a relatively unhealthy individual. If we're going to start valuing life...
Well, at least the cost of his care certainly were damages that he would not have experienced had he died.
But then the question becomes, are they offset by the benefits he obtained by living, by his visits with his grandchildren, by him being able to change his will? He's a competent individual.
There's a counter-argument to everything that you would say, because did he enjoy any of it?
Well, I mean, there's evidence that he played cards with his friends. He lived with his daughter for a year before he went on to live in the nursing home. I mean, there are several statements he made along the way after the defibrillation, thanking the nurses, for example. And a year and a half later, right after this case was filed, he's saying to the nursing home attendants, somebody's trying to kill me, help me, help me, don't let somebody kill me. What does that mean? Does the jury then take into consideration whether he's changed his mind, whether he now is glad that he's alive? Granted, this fellow passed away after 2 years.
Those all seem like things the juries sort out all of the time.
Well, I don't think
that parade of horribles, make that same argument about almost any kind of damage claim, all the what ifs, and that's what good counsel and good witnesses on both sides want to present to a jury.
But we've never asked, for example, in a wrongful death case, that the beneficiaries present evidence as to whether perhaps it was better that the decedent was gone.
Are you willing to concede then that the nurse, or whoever it was, that administered this treatment negligently did it because she ignored the written instructions by the doctor on the hospital records?
No, there has never been an admission of negligence because there were orders on file saying to defibrillate.
Well, I'm sorry. I read that there were the orders from the doctor after he discussed it with his patient. It says no cold blue, which I assume the nurse knew what cold blue means, and I assume that the nurse reads the records of her patient. And are you saying that she didn't see the no cold blue written on the records?
She was deposed in this case and was asked that question and said she couldn't recall whether she was aware of the order. She was not his nurse. The monitor went off. It was 2:30 in the morning. She was simply a nurse, saw the monitor going off.
Then a nurse is not responsible for what orders are written in the records?
No, what I'm saying is if she had been negligent, she would be responsible if the defibrillation caused him some harm, such as burns or fractures or something of that nature. It caused him no harm.
How about the stroke he received several days later?
Has nothing to do with the defibrillation. They have stipulated that the defibrillation did not cause that stroke. That was simply a matter of his life, his age, etc.
Is the negligence of the nurse not a question to be determined by the trial?
Well, there is no cause of action unless all elements are presented.
Since you're not willing to admit that she was negligent or not negligent, you're just sort of leaving it up in the air and sort of, you know, trying to get around the issues a little bit. Isn't that a question for fact for the jury to determine whether that nurse was negligent?
It's similar to a case where there would be no evidence of causation.
So you said, you're saying then that the negligence is immaterial because even if she was negligent, there's no damages.
Correct. The other elements cannot be met, and therefore you have no case to go to trial.
Okay.
Is there a sanction? Perhaps you could go to the nursing board.
Ms. Leiden,
yes.
We hear a lot these days about choice. Is there any way this patient, under these circumstances, could be given a choice not to live, to die?
Not to live, yes. I mean, and he...
How? He tried.
He tried by some confusing indications. As I said, even afterwards, he was thanking the nurses. He was then moved. Had he not wanted treatment, perhaps he shouldn't have been in the hospital.
Okay, well, I understand what you're talking about there, and I think, you know, I hadn't thought that it was a question of fact as being indicated by summary judgment. Seems to me now you're arguing it's a question of fact between the conflicting signals that the hospital got, and if it is, of course, then summary judgment shouldn't be. But I don't see it that way. I think he made a choice, and the nurses involved made a choice to preserve life.
You've answered, sure.
And because this is important.
It is important, and it would be important for a jury to consider if it was a proper claim to even be before a court. But the question of negligence without issues of causation, damages, etc., also being present means it is not, it doesn't say the
because there's no damage resulting and no causation, he could not have made an effective choice not to be resuscitated.
He could have made an effective choice, and if the hospital had refused to transport him, that would have been a problem.
Oh, that is going to happen at 2:30 in the morning.
It did happen the very same day he was transferred.
After he was brought back.
After he was defibrillated, and I should add that when he was brought back, so to speak, that lasted about 2 or 3 hours. The
yes.
doctor then took over. And
yeah, and I understand all those facts afterwards, and it seems to be conflicting signals then, but at the moment of truth, which was at 2:30 in the morning, he had previously made the choice, and is it not your argument, that notwithstanding all of that, all of the other things surrounding it, the nurse had maybe an obligation, but certainly a personal responsibility to defibrillate.
Under our public policy, she also would have to follow her own ethical standards,
mm-hmm.
and if she felt that she was unsure in any way, the standards have always been to err on the side of life. If we now want to say, don't err on the side of life, consider erring on the side of death, then we put healthcare practitioners
okay.
in a major dilemma.
And that's why I was asking the question, because it really depends, in addition to the time and the place, which shift might be on duty. Because the oath might be different from nurse to nurse or doctor to doctor.
That's why it's always
so there is no effective way for him to make a choice not to live.
No, because what would happen when they do err on the side of life, they then take time to review the issue again, see what the patient would like to do. That was done, the patient was moved. If the wrong decision had been made, there would have been no choice.
Well, counsel, you said it was confusing and there were standing orders. At the time of this incident, the chart reflected two places, no code. No code.
Well,
one.
At least one place.
And where do you put that in the chart?
Usually it goes in the doctor's order.
Doesn't it go right on the front cover?
There's been no statement in the record as to whether this was on a front cover or anything else. But the standing orders were clearly delineated.
Standing orders, you mean that's a standard procedure in your hospital if you're in
Well, when someone is put on a heart monitor, it means if the heart monitor goes off, what do you do? You do one of these several things.
Unless there's been an indication of no code.
No, that's not part of the policy. Because a no code could mean so many different things to different people. This gentleman had simply said, "Doctor, don't let me end up like my wife."
Okay.
And he wrote, "No code blue."
Your hospital have a nice glossy brochure telling people what a wonderful place it is?
Again, it's not part of the record, but I believe they're probably...
Okay, well, maybe the remedy ought to be that there ought to be a big box of big, bold letters. If you come to this hospital, you can't have the right to say, "I don't want the heroic means," or we won't honor them. Maybe that ought to be the remedy.
I don't think that's the position that they were taking, that they wouldn't honor. They tried their best. They sorted the issue out. He was transferred. He was able to leave the hospital if he wanted to at any time. He did not want to hear. But even to some docs that had he been there, he might very well have separated too. He just wanted to go to the end. I don't know if you still like counsel for the meeting to have a moment to say attention on what's going on.
We'll let Ms. Ballard do rebuttal, because we're well over time. Mr. Knapp? Mr. Knapp, let me start you with a question that may be easy for you, I don't know. But for those of us who still believe that there are some things that happen to people for which they cannot receive damages, doesn't Johnson apply to the Johnson's different facts, but doesn't the principle of Johnson apply to this case that if we err at all in this healthcare field, that we err on the side of life and not on the side of death, not put healthcare providers in the terrible dilemma of acting on orders that weren't, even assuming they were clear, that there's no damage, there still is no damage for causing someone to continue living instead of letting them die?
Your Honor, if that principle stands, proving is donated by the United States Supreme Court is a trust. The entire right to determine whether or not you're going to receive any medical treatment if you are seriously ill is a fraud, because you are totally in the hands of and at the mercy of
Well, except that a medical, but a medical, we're talking about money damages here versus taking someone's medical license or nursing license from them, are we not? Isn't there a difference there?
We're talking about significant medical damages, yes, sir.
Yep.
We are. And I would add that if that principle stands, the hospitals and doctors in this state will be permitted to not only keep you alive, but keep you in their institution and bill you of every dollar you own.
Well, the statute already, statute gives them immunity, doesn't it? If there's
no, sir, it does not.
I thought it did.
That statute contains language that says this statute does not in any way impinge on the right of a qualified patient or other patient to reject any kind of medical treatment. That's a common law principle. The statute does not apply.
I thought it gave immunity to a health care provider who doesn't carry out the wishes of or under a living will, or
it gives the health care provider the opportunity to say, "I can't in good conscience follow this. I will send you somewhere else."
Right.
And in an emergency situation, I have no argument with the health care provider going ahead and doing it. This was not an emergency situation. This no code blue order had been on the record for 3 days. If there was any question whatsoever about its meaning, its validity, or anything else, the hospital had a great opportunity to straighten that.
Well, do you really think that the doctors and hospitals, with all the effort on managed care now, moving people out of hospitals, that doctors really would not pay attention to a living will because they want to keep somebody there alive?
I'm not saying that they would. I'm saying that that would be one of the possibilities.
Well, it's a possibility, but it's not a very practical one, is it? I mean, we're talking about public policy, so I'm trying to see what the framework is and with our whatever decision we write, and I guess I'm wondering whether that's a real probability.
People like Ed Winter spend the rest of their lives somewhere at the cost of first themselves and then the state.
If Ed Winters was in a window, open window on the 10th floor of a building, ready to jump, and someone grabbed him, he said, I want to die. I've got this heart condition. I don't want to live. I want to die. I'm going to jump. And somebody grabs him and pulls him back in.
that person liable for damages?
That's an emergency situation, Your Honor. That is not what's going on here.
Well, he stated, I want to die. He can't do it anymore, clearly.
I want to die. No, sir.
No, I'm saying in my hypothetical, it's clear. He's shouting, I want... He's on the Broad Street Bridge. We have it happen, used to, quite a bit, but not anymore. But water's too shallow, I guess. But you know, they stand there, they shout, I want to die, I want to die, and somebody saves them.
Most people...
They let them continue to live. Was there damages for that?
There is a serious question about that person's mental competence. There was no question.
Well,
no,
some would argue that there's a question about someone's mental competence. Anybody who says they want to die. I mean, I don't happen to agree with them, but some would argue that, sir.
Mr. Winter never said, I want to die. Mr. Winter said, I recognize the possible benefit of resuscitation. I recognize the risks of resuscitation because my wife had, and she ended up with brain damage. And I will not put myself through that. I will not put my family through that. I will take a peaceful death.
Did he have the option to go to the hospital for care in this incident?
He was taken there by paramedics.
Now, was he not conscious when he was taken?
Yes, he was. And
he could have chosen.
Everybody in earshot heard, if my heart stops, do not shock me.
Or could he have made the choice to not go to the hospital to have his heart shocked?
He shouldn't have to make that choice, Your Honor. He could still get comfort care. He could still get medical care. He was entitled to that. He shouldn't have to die on the street because he didn't want to be the victim.
Well, at home, I mean, that's a different than the street.
He shouldn't have to die at home.
Counsel, the hospital seemed to indicate that there was some confusion as to the instructions that the nurse was to follow, that it wasn't really explicit, and it wasn't really his nurse and those things. Can you clarify that for me as to what the facts are concerning the instructions of your client?
When Mr. Winter was transferred from the emergency room to the unit, he went under standing orders. If he goes into the defibrillation or under arrhythmia, he is to be defibrillated. Those orders should not have been in place because he specifically rejected them.
Were they just sort of oral? Were they written in the...
No, sir. That's hospital policy.
What is hospital policy?
That when you go into that unit, you are to be defibrillated if something happens.
You are to be defibrillated?
Yes, sir.
All right.
Now, he had rejected that in the emergency room. Despite that, he went there under that order. That was on the 25th of May. On May 28th, 3 days later, this incident happened. On the night of the 25th, his physician came in, spoke with him, assessed his competence, assessed his sanity, and said, all right, Mr. Winter, fine. You have a no-code blue order here. He came out and talked to the patient's family, and he wrote in the progress notes, discussion with patient and family, no-code blue. There was no question. The only question has been bring up since this case was filed.
Now, are all the nursing personnel supposed to be familiar with the instructions in the file?
I would certainly think so, Your Honor. The evidence in the case submitted with the affidavit of my expert with the complaint was that a reasonably competent nurse would have known of this order and would have followed it.
For purposes of summary judgment, we have to assume that all that is true.
Yes, sir.
But there's no factual question about whether or not, you know, he should have been defibrillated.
Right.
He shouldn't have been.
Here. Right.
And then we're faced with the case, the Johnson case, where this court said, based on the real difficulty in determining any kind of damages for wrongful life, we find that that's not a cognizable cause of action.
I would dispute that that's what the Johnson case said first.
Okay.
The Johnson case said, the birth of a normal, healthy child is, as a matter of public policy, not a damage to his parents. That's what that case said. And the Bowman case decided previously that, and not overruled by that case, said that the birth of an unhealthy, sick child can be attended to the extent of that child's medical expenses.
And so forth. So you distinguish this from Johnson?
I don't think this has anything to do with Johnson or Bowman.
What is this?
This is an adult making a decision for himself.
That's what I'm saying, but it still isn't damages the issue
no.
here at Johnson and in Bowman?
Absolutely not.
Okay, so you distinguish it, who's making the choice. The Court of Appeals, interestingly, distinguished it by saying the person we're talking about, an infant at the beginning of life versus a competent adult at the end of his life.
Exactly.
It sounds emotional, doesn't it?
No, ma'am, it's not emotional. Ed Ware was an 82-year-old man who thought to himself, he realized what was going on here. I know what could happen to me if I am subjected to this treatment. I know what could happen to me if I'm not, and that is that I would die. I would rather take the chance on dying than take the chance on spending 2 years in misery. And as a result of that, he would not have suffered any of these damages had he not been treated. He has simply been dead. He would have passed on to his maker. But thanks to this hospital, he was subjected to over $100,000 in medical nursing home bills and almost two years of misery.
So what are the damages?
$100,000 in hospital and medical bills and 2 years of misery that he would not have suffered anyway.
And should we go, I mean, there's the problems that arise. The argument is, of course, that we'd say, well, which days were good? Which of those days did the person enjoy their life, which they didn't? How would the jury sort that out?
In a wrongful death case, you could make the same argument. Well, you know, yes, this man's dead, but he might have been, you know, he might have gotten cancer a year down the road and been sick. So we can't do that either. Juries do that every day.
How do you can't bring this as a wrongful death. What do you do? Bring it as a survivorship action on the basis of pain and suffering to the patient before death?
This was filed by Mr. Winter himself initially and carried on by his administrator.
I just didn't ask that. What is the legal vehicle?
A
survivorship action?
No, sir.
I mean, when you have a wrongful death case, you have the wrongful death, and then, of course, you have whatever pain and suffering occurred prior to death.
This is
just a straight negligence case brought by a decedent.
No, it was brought by a living human being who was since deceased.
So he brought it, and it was transferred. Transferred to his fiduciary?
To his administrator.
And what are...
This is no different than if he'd been injured in an automobile accident and died 3 years later of cancer that had nothing to do with the automobile accident. This is exactly the same situation. So the bottom line of this case is, if this court allows the hospital to prevail here, each and every one of the people in this room is at risk when our time comes of having the hospital screw up, do it intentionally, however it happens, and subject us to risky treatment just for the purpose of keeping us alive when what we are looking forward to is to us not of that much value.
Even the legislature has said there is immunity I still having a problem with your argument because they made that public policy statement.
And if they said that, it's unconstitutional. Well, because it flies in the face of both the Ohio Constitution and the United States Constitution.
We don't have that case yet. So.
I realize we don't, but it would be. Because, again, under the U.S. Constitution, under Cruising, and under the cases that I submitted to this court last week that have come out since my brief, there is a constitutional right to not only have informed consent to medical treatment, but informed refusal.
Well, the constitutional right to refuse it is different than the right to recover damages from somebody who negligently or perhaps intentionally or just doesn't do it.
There is no right to recover damages. The right to refuse is a fraud and a treason. It is meaningless. Without the right to refuse, the right to consent does not mean a thing.
If this case goes back to trial, what's the standard going to be for determination of liability? Reasonable standard of care?
Yes.
Is it not a reasonable standard of care for a nurse to try to save somebody's life?
Not when there's a no code order on that nurse. No, ma'am. No, sir. Not at all. And if it is, every one of us, when we go to the hospital for the last time...
That's not necessarily true. No code could have been put on the previous shift, and she walks in. I mean, there are lots of fact patterns.
The no code was put on 3 days earlier.
I understand that.
And I don't care if it was put on 15 minutes earlier. I believe that reasonable care would require that every nurse who comes into contact with that patient should have a way of knowing.
Here he is, about to die. She grabs a chart and reads it before she decides to take any of the heroic measures that she has been not only trained but sworn to do.
It is her duty to know what the parameters are before she submits, before she takes any medical treatment. It is the hospital's duty to see that she knows.
If you had wanted him to live, and she had said, wait, I have to go down to the medications unit to see what medications he's on, and ran around two floors of the hospital and then came back and it was too late.
That would be negligence.
Negligence?
Yes, sir.
Why? She did. She said she had to find out whether there was a cold blue.
There should be no question whatsoever when there is a cold blue. And if there is no cold blue sign there, if it is not immediately apparent to the nurse, obviously she goes on the side of saving the patient. I have no argument with that.
Counsel, we're into the fact pattern when the real troubling thing here is should there be recoverable damages. But on the fact pattern, as Justice Douglas just raised, wouldn't it be an entirely different matter if this patient were out on a floor and were in for surgery or something, but it said I'm 82 and I have a heart condition, and so in the chart is no code, but this patient's out in a surgery wing, and he crashes, and a nurse there grabs the crash cart and does this. You wouldn't maybe expect, but isn't that an issue of negligence, that she run down and pull a chart to double check. But here your patient is in intensive care, I take it.
He's in step down. He's not
okay.
In intensive care.
And he's in an area where there could be an expectation that you might need to administer this kind of treatment.
And
there
should also be an expectation that the patient still has a right to refuse to accept any kind of medical treatment. And this patient has refused to accept that kind of treatment, and the nurses should know about it. That was the only expert opinion in this case, is that under these circumstances, this nurse should have known.
Your point must be that the nurses, when they come on duty, they review the charts of the patient on their floor, and they know what... That's. I would guess that's what usually would. I hope that's what usually would happen.
You would certainly hope so.
Yeah.
But again, I don't want to get wrapped up in the facts of this case.
Right. That's illegal.
The facts of this case were never determined. The only issue before this court is: does a patient have a constitutionally protected right to say no thank you to a doctor in a hospital? I do not want this kind of treatment, even if it's going to cost me my life. And if the court decides that there is no remedy for a breach of that right, the right itself is a fraud. I believe that's all my time.
Thank you, Mr. Knapp.
Questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Lydon, who's going to do it? Okay. Ms. Ballard? Take a minute.
May it please the court, my name is Catherine Ballard. On this day, I'm the head of the Ohio Hospital Association, Ohio State Medical Association. I do appreciate this, and I'll be very brief. I have so many thoughts, and I have so little time. There's just two points I think I'd like to make. Number one is, you don't always see OHA and OSMA on the same side of the fence on a lot of issues. But issues that involve patient care like this one are critical to both of these associations. And they strongly endorse the position that's been taken by Ms. Lydon today on behalf of the hospital. So we simply encourage this court in terms of the position that the hospital has taken. The second point that I want to make is, I think, to emphasize what Justice Douglas said earlier, for every wrong, there is not necessarily a right. And if we are going to err, assuming there was negligence here, we've got to err on the side of life. Technology is moving so fast, and the ethics of trying to keep up with that is a struggle every day. Even if we look at something as simple as penicillin in our lifetime, penicillin was considered a miracle drug that saved lives. Then it has to become the standard of care.
Well, Counsel, isn't our problem here, we're asked to write a sweeping rule. Thoughts of damages for wrongful life, in which the plaintiff says this is not that case, that is, that you all mischaracterize it as being negative. And this damage issue arms around that. But you're asking for a rule that says never ever, regardless of what the fact pattern is that develops. I assume you aren't going so far as to say if we had a fact pattern where it was just blatantly intentional that we ignored the wishes, let's say that's a different case, but where it's negligence, there just is no fact pattern under which you could get to a jury and have a judge charging as to the law and what you can consider and what you can't consider and having counterbalancing evidence. You just want to sweep it all away and say there can never ever be damages.
I don't think we're trying to sweep away a rule. I think what we're encouraging the court to do is to not create a new rule. I think the rule of the land is the sanctity of life. I think the Hippocratic Oath is the sanctity of life. That every decision this court has made is the sanctity, the importance of life. That one is not to judge the quality of that life, but the fact of life itself. And what the appellees are asking this court to do is to disregard that and to actually encourage erring on the side of death.
But you're saying when even when negligence is proved, mm-hmm. even when causation is proved, that there never ever can be damages.
I'm saying that today, here and now, based upon everything that I know, ethically, yes, that's what I'm saying. That in fact, we should not permit damages because someone has erred on the side of life, and so you've lived maybe another day or another week or another month. There is still a remedy. There is still injunctive relief. If you feel that a hospital or a doctor is inappropriately keeping someone alive, you can go into court and ask for injunctive relief and say, no, they shouldn't be allowed to do this. And you could have that changed. But to award damages because a healthcare professional is trying to do what they have been sworn to do, to me, that goes totally contrary to public policy. Perhaps it's something that's better left to the legislature down the line. But medicine is not so quite as precise a science as I think athletes would like for it to be. And there are situations where there is confusion. And in that case, I think we do have to err on the side of life. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Miller. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. The marshal, please adjourn the court.
All rise.